remembered what her uncle had said of baskets and winches. "The Lannisters may have their pride," she told Maya, "but the Tullys are born with better sense. I have ridden all day, and the best part of a night. Tell them to lower a basket. I shall ride with the turnips." The sun was well over the mountains by the time Catelyn Stark finally reached the area. A stocky, silver-haired man in a sky-blue cloak and hammered moon and falcon breastplate helped her from the basket. Sir Vardas Egan, captain of John Aaron's household guard. Beside him stood Maester Coleman, thin and nervous, with too little hair and too much neck. "Lady Stark," Sir Vardas said, "the pleasure is as great as it is unanticipated." Maester Coleman bobbed his head in agreement.
"Indeed it is, my lady, indeed it is. I have sent word to your sister. She left orders to be awakened the instant you arrived."
"Well, I hope she had a good night's rest," Catelyn said with a certain bite in her tone that seemed to go unnoticed. The men escorted her from the winch room up a spiral stair. The Eyrie was a small castle by the standards of the great houses, seven slender white towers bunched as tightly as arrows in a quiver, on a shoulder of the great mountain. It had no need of stables, nor smithies, nor kennels, but Ned said its granary was as large as Winterfell's, and its towers could house 500 men. Yet it seemed strangely deserted to Catelyn as she passed through it, its pale stone halls echoing and empty. Lysa was waiting alone in her solar, still clad in her bedrobes, her long auburn hair tumbled unbound across bare white shoulders and down her back. A maid stood behind her, brushing out the night's tangles. But when Catelyn entered, her sister rose to her feet, smiling. "Cat," she said, "oh, Cat, how good it is to see you, my sweet sister." She ran across the chamber and wrapped her sister in her arms. "How long it has been," Lysa murmured against her. "Oh, how very, very long." It had been 5 years, in truth. 5 cruel years for Lysa. They had taken their toll. Her sister was 2 years the younger, yet she looked older now. Shorter than Catelyn, Lysa had grown thick of body, pale and puffy of face. She had the blue eyes of the Tullys, but hers were pale and watery, never still. Her small mouth had turned petulant. As Catelyn held her, she remembered the slender, high-breasted girl who waited beside her that day in the Sept at River Run, how lovely and full of hope she had been. All that remained of her sister's beauty was a great fall of thick auburn hair that cascaded to her waist. "You look well," Catelyn lied. "But tired." Her sister broke the embrace. "Tired, yes, oh yes." She seemed to notice the others then, her maid, Maester Coleman, Sir Vardas. "Leave us," she told them. "I wish to speak to my sister alone." She held Catelyn's hand as they withdrew, and dropped it the instant the door closed. Catelyn saw her face change. It was as if the sun had gone behind a cloud. "Have you taken leave of your senses?" Lysa snapped at her. "To bring him here? Without a word of permission? Without so much as a warning? To drag us into your quarrels with the Lannisters?" "My quarrels?" Catelyn could scarce believe what she was hearing. A great fire burned in the hearth, but there was no trace of warmth in Lysa's voice. "They were your quarrels first, sister. It was you who sent me that cursed letter, you who wrote that the Lannisters had murdered your husband. To warn you so you could stay away from them. I never meant to fight them. Gods, Cat, do you know what you've done?" "Mother," a small voice said. Lysa whirled, her heavy robe swirling around her. Robert Aaron, Lord of the Eyrie, stood in the doorway, clutching a ragged cloth doll and looking at them with large eyes. He was a painfully thin child, small for his age, and sickly all his days, and from time to time he trembled. The shaking sickness, the maesters called it.
I heard voices.
Small wonder, Catelyn thought. Lysa had almost been shouting. Still, her sister looked daggers at her. This is your Aunt Catelyn, baby. My sister, Lady Stark. Do you remember? The boy glanced at her blankly.
I think so,
he said, blinking, though he had been less than a year old the last time Catelyn had seen him. Lysa seated herself near the fire and said, Come to mother, my sweet one. She straightened his bedclothes and fussed with his fine brown hair. Isn't he beautiful? And strong, too. Don't you believe the things you hear? John knew. The seed is strong, he told me. His last words. He kept saying Robert's name, and he grabbed my arm so hard he left marks. Tell them, the seed is strong. His seed. He wanted everyone to know what a good, strong boy my baby was going to be. Lysa, Catelyn said, if you're right about the Lannisters, all the more reason we must act quickly. Not in front of the baby, Lysa said. He has a delicate temper. Don't you, sweet one? The boy is Lord of the Eyrie and Defender of the Vale, Catelyn reminded her. And these are no times for delicacy. Ned thinks it may come to war. Quiet! Lysa snapped at her. You're scaring the boy. Little Robert took a quick peek over his shoulder at Catelyn and began to tremble. His doll fell to the rushes, and he pressed himself against his mother. Don't be afraid, my sweet baby, Lysa whispered. Mother's here. Nothing will hurt you. She opened her robe and drew out a pale, heavy breast, tipped with red. The boy grabbed for it eagerly, buried his face against her chest, and began to suck. Lysa stroked his hair. Catelyn was at a loss for words. John Aaron's son, she thought, incredulously. She remembered her own baby, three-year-old Rickon, half the age of this boy and five times as fierce. Small wonder the Lords of the Vale were restive. For the first time she understood why the king had tried to take the child away from his mother to fuster with the Lannisters. We're safe here, Lysa was saying. Whether to her or to the boy, Catelyn was not sure. Don't be a fool, Catelyn said, her anger rising in her. No one is safe. If you think hiding here will make the Lannisters forget you, you are sadly mistaken. Lysa covered the boy's ear with her hand. Even if they could bring an army through the mountains and past the bloody gates, the area is impregnable. You saw for yourself, no enemy could ever reach us up here. Catelyn wanted to slap her. Uncle Brynden had tried to warn her, she realized. No castle is impregnable. This one is, Lysa insisted. Everyone says so. The only thing is, what am I to do with this imp you've brought me?
Is he a bad man?
The Lord of the Eyrie asked, his mother's breast popping from his mouth, the nipple wet and red. A very bad man, Lysa told him as she covered herself. But mother won't let him harm my little baby.
Make him fly,
Robert said eagerly. Lysa stroked her son's hair. Perhaps we will, she murmured. Perhaps that is just what we will do.
John. The hill, jutted above the dense tangle of forest, rising solitary and sudden, its windswept heights visible for miles off. The wildlings called it the Fist of the First Men, Ranger said. It did look like a fist, Jon Snow thought, punching up through the earth and wood, its bare brown slopes knuckled with stone. He rode to the top, with Lord Mormont and the officers, leaving Ghost below under the trees. The direwolf had run off three times as they climbed, twice returning reluctantly to John's whistle. The third time, the Lord Commander lost patience and snapped, "Let him go, boy! I want to reach the crest before dusk. Find the wolf later!" The way up was steep and stony, the summit crowned by a chest-high wall of tumbled rocks. They had to circle some distance west before they found a gap large enough to admit the horses.
"This is good ground,"
Thorin, the old bear proclaimed when at last they attained the top. We could scarce hope for better. We'll make our camp here to await Halfhand. The Lord Commander swung down off his saddle, dislodging the raven from his shoulder. Complaining loudly, the bird took to the air. The views atop the hill were bracing, yet it was the ring wall that drew John's eye, the weathered grey stones with their white patches of lichen, their beards of green moss. It was said that the fist had been a ring fort of the first men in the Dawn Age. An old place and strong, Thorin Smallwood said.
Old!
Mormont's raven screamed as it flapped in noisy circles about their heads.
Old! Old! Old!
Quiet! Mormont growled at the bird. The old bear was too proud to admit to weakness, but John was not deceived. The strain of keeping up with younger men was taking its toll.
These heights will be easy to defend if need be, Thorin pointed out as he walked his horse along the ring of stones, his sable-trimmed cloak stirring in the wind.
Yes, this place will do. The old bear lifted a hand to the wind, and Raven landed on his forearm, claws scrabbling against the black ringmail. What about water, my lord? John wondered.
We crossed a brook at the foot of the hill.
Long climb for a drink, John pointed out, and outside the ring of stones. Thorin said,
Are you too lazy to climb a hill, boy?
When Lord Mormont said, We're not like to find another place as strong. We'll carry water and make certain we're well supplied. John knew better than to argue. So the command was given, and the brothers of the Night's Watch raised their camp behind the stone ring the first men had made. Black tents sprouted like mushrooms after a rain, and blankets and bedrolls covered the bare ground. Stewards tethered the garrons in long lines and saw them fed and watered. Foresters took their axes to the trees in the waning afternoon light to harvest enough wood to see them through the night. A score of builders set to clearing brush, digging latrines, and untying their bundles of fire-hardened stakes.
I will have every opening in the ring wall ditched and staked before dark, the old bear had commanded.
Once he'd put up the Lord Commander's tent and seen to their horses, John Snow descended the hill in search of Ghost. The direwolf came at once, all in silence. One moment, John was striding beneath the trees, whistling and shouting, alone in the green, pine cones and fallen leaves under his feet. The next, the great white direwolf was walking beside him, pale as morning mist. But when they reached the ring fort, Ghost balked again. He padded forward wearily to sniff at the gap in the stones, and then retreated, as if he did not like what he smelled. John tried to grab him by the scruff of his neck and haul him bodily inside the ring. No easy task. The wolf weighed as much as he did, and was stronger by far.
Ghost, what's wrong with you?
It was not like him to be so unsettled. In the end, John had to give it up. As you will, he told the wolf. Go hunt. The red eyes watched him as he made his way back through the mossy stones. They ought to be safe here. The hill offered commanding views, and the slopes were precipitous to the north and west, and only slightly more gentle to the east. Yet as the dawn deepened and darkness seeped into the hollows between the trees, John's sense of foreboding grew.
This is the haunted forest, he told himself. Maybe there are ghosts here, the spirits of the first men. This was their place once. Stop acting the boy, he told himself.
Clambering atop the piled rocks, John gazed off toward the setting sun. He could see the light shimmering like hammered gold off the surface of the milk water as it curved away to the south. Upriver, the land was more rugged, the dense forest giving way to a series of bare, stony hills that rose high and wild to the north and west. On the horizon stood the mountains, like a great shadow, range on range of them, receding into the blue-grey distance, their jagged peaks sheathed eternally in snow. Even from afar, they looked vast and cold and inhospitable. Closer at hand, it was the trees that ruled. To south and east, the wood went on as far as John could see, a vast tangle of root and limb painted in a thousand shades of green, with here and there a patch of red where a weirwood shouldered through the pines and sentinels, or a blush of yellow where some broadleaves had begun to turn. When the wind blew, he could hear the creak and groan of branches older than he was. A thousand leaves fluttered, and for a moment the forest seemed a deep green sea, storm-tossed, and heaving, eternal, and unknowable. Ghost was not like to be alone down there, he thought. Anything could be moving under that sea, creeping toward the ring fort through the dark of the wood, concealed beneath those trees. Anything. How would they ever know? He stood there for a long time, until the sun vanished behind the saw-toothed mountains and darkness began to creep through the forest.
John, Samuel Tarley called up. I thought it looked like you. Are you well?
Well enough, John hopped down. How did you fare today?
Well, I fared well, truly.
John was not about to share his disquiet with his friend, not when Samuel Tarley was at last beginning to find his courage. The old bear means to wait here for Corin Halfhand and the men from the Shadow Tower.
It seems a strong place, said Sam, a ring fort of the first men. Do you think there were battles fought here?
No doubt. You'd best get a bird ready. Mormont will want to send back word.
I wish I could send them all. They hate being caged.
You would too, if you could fly.
If I could fly, I'd be back at Castle Black eating a port pie, said Sam.
John clapped him on the shoulder with his burned hand. They walked back through the camp together. Cook fires were being lit all around them. Overhead, the stars were coming out. The long red tail of Mormont's torch burned as bright as the moon. John heard the ravens before he saw them. Some were calling his name. The birds were not shy when it came to making noise. They feel it too. I'd best see to the old bear, he said. He gets noisy when he isn't fed as well. He found Mormont talking with Thorin Smallwood and a half a dozen other officers.
There you are, the old man said gruffly. Bring us some hot wine, if you would. The night is chilly.
Yes, my lord. John built a cook fire, claimed a small cask of Mormont's favourite robust red from stores, and poured it into a kettle. He hung the kettle above the flames while he gathered the rest of his ingredients. The old bear was particular about his hot spiced wine, so much cinnamon and so much nutmeg and so much honey, not a drop more. Raisins and nuts and dried berries, but no lemon. That was the rankest sort of southern heresy, which was queer, since he always took lemon in his morning beer. The drink must be hot, to warm a man properly, the Lord Commander insisted, but the wine must never be allowed to come to a boil. John kept a careful eye on the kettle. As he worked, he could hear the voices from inside the tent. Jarman Buckle said,
"The easiest road, up into the Frostfangs, is to follow the Milkwater back to its source. Yet if we go that path, Raider will know of our approach, certain as sunrise."
"The Giant Stair might serve," said Sir Malador Locke,
"or the Skirling Pass, if it's clear."
The wine was steaming. John lifted the kettle off the fire, filled 8 cups, and carried them into the tent. The old bear was peering at the crude map Sam had drawn him that night back at Craster's Keep. He took a cup from John's tray, tried a swallow of the wine, and gave a brusque nod of approval. His raven hopped down his arm.
"Corn,"
it said.
"Corn! Corn!"
Sir Otin Withers waved the wine away.
"I would not go into the mountains at all," he said in a thin, tired voice. "The Frostfangs have a cruel bite, even in summer, and now, if we should be caught by a storm—"
"I do not mean to risk the Frostfangs unless I must," said Mormont. "Wildlings can no more live on snow and stone than we can. They will emerge from the heights soon, and for a host of any size, the only route is along the Milkwater. If so, we are strongly placed here. They cannot hope to slip by us.
They may not wish to. They are thousands, and we will be 300 when the Halfhand reaches us. Sir Malador accepted a cup from John.
If it comes to battle, we could not hope for better ground than here, declared Mormont. We'll strengthen the defences. Pits and spikes, calthops scattered on the slopes, every breach mended. Jarman, I'll want your sharpest eyes as watchers, a ring of them, all around us, and along the river, to warn of any approach. Hide them up in trees. And we'd best start bringing up water, too, more than we need. We'll dig cisterns. It will keep the men occupied, and may prove needful later.
My rangers, started Thorin Smallwood.
Your rangers will limit their ranging to this side of the river until the Halfhand reaches us. After that, we'll see. I will not lose more of my men.
Mant Raider might be massing his host a day's ride from here, and we'd never know, Smallwood complained.
We know where the wildlings are massing, Mormon came back. We had it from Cresta. I mislike the man, but I do not think he'd lie to us on this.
As you say, Smallwood took a sullen leave. The others finished their wine and followed more courteously.
"Shall I bring your supper, my lord?" John asked.
"Corn!"
the raven cried. Mormont did not answer at once. When he did, he said only, "Did your wolf find game today?"
"He's not back yet."
"We could do with fresh meat."
Mormont dug into a sack and offered his raven a handful of corn.
"You think I'm wrong to keep the rangers close?"
"It's not for me to say, my lord."
"It is, if you're asked.
If the rangers must stay in sight of the fist, I don't see how they can hope to find my uncle," John admitted.
"They can't."
The raven pecked at the kernels in the old bear's palm.
200 men or 10,000. The country is too vast."
The corn gone, Mormont turned his hand over.
"You would not give up the search?"
"Maester Aemon thinks you clever."
Mormont moved the raven to his shoulder. The bird tilted its head to one side, little eyes aglitter.
The answer was there.
"Is it? It seemed to me that it might be easier for one man to find 200 than 200 to find one."
The raven gave a cackling scream, but the old bear smiled through the grey of his beard.
"This many men and horses leave a trail even Aemon could follow. On this hill our fires ought to be visible as far off as the foothills of the Frostfangs. If Ben Stark is alive and free, he will come to us, I have no doubt."
"Yes," said John, "but what if—"
"He's dead?"
Mormont asked, not unkindly. John nodded, reluctantly.
"Dead,"
the raven said.
"Dead, dead."
"He may come to us anyway," the old bear said, "as Arthur did, and Jaffa Flowers. I dread that as much as you, John. But we must admit the possibility."
"Dead,"
the raven cawed, ruffling its wings. Its voice grew louder and more shrill.
"Dead."
Mormont stroked the bird's black feathers and stifled a sudden yawn with the back of his hand.
"I will forsake supper, I believe. Rest will serve me better. Wake me at first light."
"Sleep well, my lord." John gathered up the empty cups and stepped outside. He heard distant laughter, the plaintive sound of pipes. A great blaze was crackling in the centre of the camp, and he could smell stew cooking. The old bear might not be hungry, but John was. He drifted over toward the fire. Dywin was holding forth, spoon in hand.
"I know this wood as well as any man alive, and I tell you, I wouldn't care to ride through it alone tonight. Can't you smell it?"
Gren was staring at him with wide eyes, but Dolorous Ed said,
"All I smell is the shit of 200 horses, eh? And their stew, which has a similar aroma, now I come to sniff it."
"I've got your similar aroma right here." Haik patted his dirk. Grumbling, he filled John's bowl from the kettle. The stew was thick with barley, carrot and onion, with here and there a ragged shred of salt beef, softened in the cooking.
"What is it you smell, Dywin?"
asked Wren. The forester sucked on his spoon for a moment. He had taken out his teeth. His face was leathery and wrinkled, his hands gnarled as old roots.
"Seems to me like it smells, well, cold."
"Your head's as wooden as your teeth," Hake told him. "There's no smell to cold."
"There is," thought John, remembering the night in the Lord Commander's chambers. "It smells like death." Suddenly, he was not hungry anymore. He gave his stew to Gren, who looked in need of an extra supper to warm him against the night. The wind was blowing briskly when he left. By morning, frost would cover the ground, and the tent ropes would be stiff and frozen. A few fingers of spice wine slushed in the bottom of the kettle. John fed fresh wood to the fire and put the kettle over the flames to reheat. He flexed his fingers as he waited, squeezing and spreading until the hand tingled. The first watch had taken up their stations around the perimeter of the camp. Torches flickered all along the ring wall. The night was moonless, but a thousand stars shone overhead. A sound rose out of the darkness, faint and distant, but unmistakable, the howling of wolves. Their voices rose and fell, a chilly song and lonely. It made the hairs rise along the back of his neck. Across the fire, a pair of red eyes regarded him from the shadows. The light of the flames made them glow. "Ghost!" John breathed, surprised. "So you came inside after all, eh?" The white wolf often hunted all night. He had not expected to see him again till daybreak. "Was the hunting so bad?" he asked. "Here, to me, ghost." The direwolf circled the fire, sniffing John, sniffing the wind, never still. It did not seem as if he were after meat right now. "When the dead came walking, ghost knew. He woke me, warned me." Alarmed, he got to his feet. "Is something out there? Ghost, do you have a scent?" "Dywin said he smelled cold." The direwolf loped off, stopped, looked back. "He wants me to follow." Pulling up the hood of his cloak, John walked away from the tents, away from the warmth of his fire, past the lines of shaggy little garrons. One of the horses whickered nervously when Ghost padded by. John soothed him with a word and paused to stroke his muzzle. He could hear the wind whistling through cracks in the rocks as they neared the ring wall. A voice called out a challenge. John stepped into the torchlight. "I need to fetch water for the Lord Commander."
"Go on, then," the guard said. "Be quick about it."
Huddled beneath his black cloak, with his hood drawn up against the wind, the man never even looked to see if he had a bucket. John slipped sideways between two sharpened stakes, while Ghost slid beneath them. A torch had been thrust down into a crevice, its flames flying pale orange banners when the gusts came. He snatched it up as he squeezed through the gap between the stones. Ghost went racing down the hill. John followed more slowly, the torch thrust out before him as he made his descent. The camp sounds faded behind him. The night was black, the slope steep, stony, and uneven. A moment's inattention would be a sure way to break an ankle, or his neck. "What am I doing?" he asked himself as he picked his way down. The trees stood beneath him, warriors armored in bark and leaf, deployed in their silent ranks, awaiting the command to storm the hill. Black they seemed. It was only when his torchlight brushed against them that John glimpsed a flash of green. Faintly he heard the sound of water flowing over rocks. Ghost vanished in the underbrush. John struggled after him, listening to the call of the brook, to the leaves sighing in the wind. Branches clutched at his cloak, while overhead thick limbs twined together and shut out the stars. He found Ghost lapping from the stream. "Ghost," he called, "to me, now." When the direwolf raised his head, his eyes glowed red and baleful, and water streamed down from his jaws like slava. There was something fierce and terrible about him in that instant. And then he was off, bounding past John, racing through the trees. "Ghost, no, stay!" he shouted, but the wolf paid no heed. The lean white shape was swallowed by the dark, and John had only two choices, to climb the hill again, alone, or to follow. He followed, angry, holding the torch out low so he could see the rocks that threatened to trip him with every step, the thick roots that seemed to grab at his feet, the holes where a man could twist an ankle. Every few feet he called again for Ghost, but the night wind was swirling amongst the trees, and it drank the words. "This is madness," he thought, as he plunged deeper into the trees. He was about to turn back when he glimpsed a flash of white off ahead and to the right, back toward the hill. He jogged after it, cursing under his breath. A quarter way round the fist, he chased the wolf before he lost him again. Finally, he stopped to catch his breath amidst the scrub, thorns, and tumbled rocks at the base of the hill. Beyond the torchlight, the dark pressed close. A soft, scrabbling noise made him turn. John moved towards the sound, stepping carefully among boulders and thorn bushes. Behind a fallen tree, he came on Ghost again. The dire wolf was digging furiously, kicking up dirt. "What have you found?" John lowered the torch, revealing a rounded mound of soft earth. "A grave," he thought. "But whose?" He knelt, jammed the torch into the ground beside him. The soil was loose, sandy. John pulled it out by the fistful. There were no stones, no roots. Whatever was here had been put here recently. 2 feet down, his fingers touched cloth. He had been expecting a corpse, fearing a corpse, but this was something else. He pushed against the fabric and he felt small, hard shapes beneath, unyielding. There was no smell, no sign of grave worms. Ghost backed off and sat on his haunches, watching. John brushed the loose soil away to reveal a rounded bundle, perhaps 2 feet across. He jammed his fingers down around the edges and worked it loose. When he pulled it free, whatever was inside shifted and clinked. Treasure, he thought. But the shapes were wrong to be coins, and the sound was wrong for metal. A length of frayed rope bound the bundle together. John unsheathed his dagger and cut it, groped for the edges of the cloth and pulled. The bundle turned, and its contents spilled out onto the ground, glittering dark and bright. He saw a dozen knives, leaf-shaped spearheads, numerous arrowheads. John picked up a dagger blade, featherlight and shiny black, hiltless. Torchlight ran along its edge, a thin orange line that spoke of razor sharpness. Dragonglass, what the maesters call obsidian. Had Ghost uncovered some ancient cache of the children of the forest, buried here for thousands of years? The fist of the first man was an old place, only... Beneath the dragonglass was an old war horn, made from an oryx horn and banded in bronze. John shook the dirt from inside it, and a stream of arrowheads fell out. He let them fall and pulled up a corner of the cloth the weapons had been wrapped in, rubbing it between his fingers. Good wool, thick, a double weave, damp but not rotted. It could not have been long in the ground. And it was dark. He seized a handful and pulled it close to the torch. Not dark. Black. Even before John stood and shook it out, he knew what he had. The black cloak of a sworn brother of the Night's Watch. Bran. Alebelly found him in the forge, working the bellows for Micken.
"Maester wants you in the turret, my lord prince. There's been a bird from the king."
From Rob? Excited, Bran did not wait for Hodor, but let Alebelly carry him up the steps. He was a big man, though not so big as Hodor, and nowhere near as strong. By the time they reached the maester's turret, he was red-faced and puffing. Rickon was there before them, and both Walder Freys as well. Maester Lewin sent Alebelly away and closed his door.
"My lords," he said gravely, "we have had a message from His Grace, with both good news and ill. He has won a great victory in the west, shattering a Lannister army at the place named Oxcross, and has taken several castles as well. He writes us from Ashmark, formerly the stronghold of House Marbrand."
Rickon tugged at the maester's rope.
"Is Rob coming home?" "Not just yet, I fear. There are battles yet to fight."
"Was it Lord Tywin he defeated?" asked Bran.
"No," said the maester. "Sir Stafford Lannister commanded the enemy host. He was slain in the battle."
Bran had never even heard of Sir Stafford Lannister. He found himself agreeing with Big Walder when he said, "Lord Tywin is the only one who matters."
"Tell Rob I want him to come home," said Rickon. "He can bring his wolf home too, and mother and father."
Though he knew Lord Eddard was dead, sometimes Rickon forgot. Willfully, Bran suspected. His little brother was stubborn, as only a boy of four can be. Bran was glad for Rob's victory, but disquieted as well. He remembered what Usher had said the day his brother had led his army out of Winterfell.
"He's marching the wrong way,"
the wildling woman had insisted.
"Sadly, no victory is without cost." Maester Lewin turned to the Walders. "My lords, your uncle, Sir Stevrin Frey, was among those who lost their lives at Oxcross. He took a wound in the battle," Rob writes. "It was not thought to be serious, but 3 days later he died in his tent, asleep."
Big Walder shrugged.
"He was very old, 65, I think. Too old for battles. He was always saying he was tired."
Little Walder hooted.
"Tired of waiting for our grandfather to die, you mean? Does this mean Sir Eamon's the heir now?"
"Don't be stupid,"
his cousin said.
"The sons of the first son come before the second son. Sir Ryman is next in line, and then Edwin, and Black Walder, and Petyr Pimple, and then Aegon, and all his sons."
"Ryman is old too," said little Walder. "Past 40, I bet, and he has a bad belly. Do you think he'll be lord?"
"I'll be lord. I don't care if he is."
Maester Lewin cut in sharply.
"You ought to be ashamed of such talk, my lords. Where is your grief? Your uncle is dead."
"Yes," said little Walder. "We're very sad."
They weren't, though. Bran got a sick feeling in his belly.
"They like the taste of this dish better than I do."
He asked Maester Lewin to be excused.
"Very well."
The maester rang for help. Hodor must have been busy in the stables. It was Usher who came. She was stronger than Alebelly, though, and had no trouble lifting Bran in her arms and carrying him down the steps. "Usher," Bran asked as they crossed the yard, "do you know the way north, to the wall and even past?"
"The way's easy. Look for the ice dragon and chase the blue star in the rider's eye."
She backed through a door and started up the winding steps. "And there are still giants there, and the rest, the others, and the children of the forest too?"
"The giants I've seen, the children I've heard tell of, and the white walkers. Why do you want to know?"
"Did you ever see a three-eyed crow?"
"No," she laughed, "and I can't say I'd want to."
Usher kicked open the door to his bedchamber and set him in his window seat, where he could watch the yard below. It seemed only a few heartbeats after she took her leave that the door opened again, and Jojen Reed entered unbidden, with his sister Mira behind him. "You heard about the bird?" Bran asked. The other boy nodded. "It wasn't a supper, like you said. It was a letter from Rob, and we didn't eat it, but—"
"The green dreams take strange shapes sometimes,"
Jojen admitted.
"The truth of them is not always easy to understand."
"Tell me the bad thing you dreamed," Bran said, the bad thing that is coming to Winterfell.
Does my Lord Prince believe me now? Will he trust my words, no matter how queer they sound in his ears?
Bran nodded.
It is the sea that comes.
The sea?
I dreamed that the sea was lapping all round Winterfell. I saw black waves crashing against the gates and towers, and then the salt water came flowing over the walls and filled the castle. Drowned men were floating in the yard. When I first dreamed the dream, back at Greywater, I didn't know their faces, but now I do. That Ale Belly is one, the guard who called our names at the feast. Your Septon's another, your Smith as well. Micken?
Bran was as confused as he was dismayed.
But the sea is hundreds and hundreds of leagues away, and Winterfell's walls are so high the water couldn't get in, even if it did come. In the dark of night, the salt sea will flow over these walls, said Jojen. I saw the dead, bloated and drowned. We have to tell them, Bran said, Ale Belly and Micken and Septon Shale. Tell them not to drown. It will not save them, replied the boy in green.
Mira came to the window seat and put a hand on his shoulder.
They will not believe, Bran, no more than you did.
Jojen sat on Bran's bed.
Tell me what you dream.
He was scared even then, but he had sworn to trust them, and the Stark of Winterfell keeps his sworn word.
There's different kinds, he said slowly. There's the wolf dreams, but those aren't so bad as the others. I run and hunt and kill squirrels. And there's dreams when the crow comes and tells me to fly. Sometimes the tree is in those dreams, too, calling my name. That frightens me. But the worst dreams are when I fall.
He looked down into the yard, feeling miserable.
I never used to fall before. When I climbed, I went every place, up on the roofs and along the walls. I used to feed the crows in the burnt tower. Mother was afraid that I would fall, but I knew I never would. Only I did. And now, when I sleep, I fall all the time.
Mira gave his shoulder a squeeze.
Is that all?
I guess.
Warg, said Jojen Reed.
Bran looked at him, his eyes wide.
What? Warg. Shape-changer, beastlin, that is what they will call you, if they should ever hear of your wolf dreams.
The names made him afraid again.
Who will call me? Your own folk, in fear. Some will hate you if they know what you are. Some will even try to kill you.
Old Nan told scary stories of beastlings and shape-changers sometimes. In the stories, they were always evil.
I'm not like that, Bran said. I'm not. It's only dreams. The wolf dreams are no true dreams. You have your eye closed tight when you're awake, but as you drift off, it flutters open, and your soul seeks out its other half. The power is strong in you.
I don't want it. I want to be a knight.
A knight is what you want. A warg is what you are. You can't change that, Bran. You can't deny it or push it away. You are the winged wolf, but you will never fly.
Jojen got up and walked to the window.
Unless you open your eye.
He put two fingers together and poked Bran in the forehead hard. When he raised his hand to the spot, Bran felt only the smooth, unbroken skin. There was no eye, not even a closed one.
How can I open it if it's not there? You will never find the eye with your fingers, Bran. You must search with your heart.
Jojen studied Bran's face with those strange green eyes.
Or are you afraid?
Maester Luwin said There's nothing in dreams that a man need fear.
There is,
said Jojen.
What? The past, the future, the truth.
They left him more muddled than before. When he was alone, Bran tried to open his third eye, but he didn't know how. No matter how he wrinkled his forehead and poked it, he couldn't see any different than he'd done before. In the days that followed, he tried to warn others about what Jojen had seen, but it didn't go as he wanted. Micken thought it was funny.
The sea, is it? Happens I always wanted to see the sea. Never got where I could go to it, though. So now it's coming to me, is it? The gods are good to take such trouble for a poor smith.
The gods will take me when they see fit,
Septon Shale said quietly.
Though I scarcely think it likely that I'll drown, Bran. I grew up on the banks of the White Knife, you know. I'm quite the strong swimmer.
Alebelly was the only one who paid the warning any heed. He went to talk to Jojen himself, and afterwards stopped bathing and refused to go near the well. Finally, he stank so bad that six of the other guards threw him into a tub of scalding water and scrubbed him raw, while he screamed that they were going to drown him like the frog boy had said. Thereafter he scowled whenever he saw Bran or Jojen about the castle and muttered under his breath. It was a few days after Alebelly's bath that Sir Roderick returned to Winterfell with his prisoner, a fleshy young man with fat, moist lips and long hair who smelled like a privy, even worse than Alebelly had.
"Reek is called," Hayhead said when Bran asked who he was. "I never heard his true name. He served the bastard of Bolton and helped him murder Lady Ornwood, they say."
The bastard himself was dead, Bran learned that evening over supper. Sir Roderick's men had caught him on Hornwood land doing something horrible. Bran wasn't quite sure what, but it seemed to be something you did without your clothes, and shot him down with arrows as he tried to ride away. But they came too late for poor Lady Hornwood, though. After their wedding, the bastard had locked her in a tower and neglected to feed her. Bran had heard men saying that when Sir Roderick had smashed down the door, he found her with her mouth all bloody and her fingers chewed off.
"The monster has tied us a thorny knot," the old knight told Maester Lewin. "Like it or not, Lady Hornwood was his wife. He made her say the vows before both Septon and Hartree, and bedded her that very night before witnesses. She signed a will naming him as heir and fixed her seal to it. Vows made at sword point are not valid," the maester argued. "Roose Bolton may not agree. Not with land at issue."
Sir Roderick looked unhappy.
"Would that I could take this serving man's head off as well. He's as bad as his master. But I fear I must keep him alive until Rob returns from his wars. He's the only witness to the worst of the bastard's crimes. Perhaps when Lord Bolton hears his tale, he will abandon his claim. But meantime, we have Manderley knights and Dreadfort men killing one another in Hornwood forests, and I lack the strength to stop them."
The old knight turned in his seat and gave Bran a stern look.
"And what have you been about while I've been away, my lord prince? Commanding our guardsmen not to wash? Do you want them smelling like this reek? Is that it?"
"The sea is coming here," Bran said. "Jojen saw it in a green dream. Alebelly is going to drown." Maester Lewin tugged at his chain collar.
The reed boy believes he sees the future in his dream, Sir Roderick. I've spoken to Bran about the uncertainty of such prophecies, but if truth be told, there is trouble along the stony shore. Raiders in longships, plundering fishing villages, raping and burning.
Leobald Tallheart has sent his nephew, Benfred, to deal with them, but I expect they'll take to their ships and flee at the first sight of armed men.
Aye, and strike somewhere else. The others take all such cowards. They would never dare, no more than the bastard of Bolton, if our main strength were not 1,000 leagues south.
Sir Roderick looked at Bran.
What else did the lad tell you?
He said the water would flow over our walls. He saw Alebelly drowned, and Micken, and Septon Shale too.
Sir Roderick frowned.
Well, should it happen that I need to ride against these raiders myself, I shan't take Alebelly then. He didn't see me drowned, did he? No? Oh, good.
It heartened Bran to hear that.
Maybe they won't drown then, he thought, if they stay away from the sea.
Mira thought so too, later that night, when she and Jojen met Bran in his room to play a three-sided game of tiles. But her brother shook his head.
The things I see in green dreams can't be changed.
That made his sister angry.
Why would the gods send a warning if we can't heed it and change what's to come?
I don't know, Jojen said sadly.
If you were Alebelly, you'd probably jump into the well and have done with it. He should fight, and Bran should too.
Me? Bran suddenly felt afraid.
What should I fight? Am I going to drown too?
Mira looked at him guiltily.
I shouldn't have said.
He could tell she was hiding something.
Did you see me in a green dream? He asked Jojen nervously. Was I drowned?
Not drowned,
Jojen spoke as if every word pained him.
I dreamed of the man who came today, the one they call Reek. You and your brother lay dead at his feet, and he was skinning off your faces with a long red blade.
Mira rose to her feet.
If I went to the dungeon, I could drive a spear right through his heart. How could he murder Bran if he was dead?
The jailers will stop you, Jojen said.
The guards. And if they tell them why you want him dead, they'll never believe.
I have guards too, Bran reminded them. Alebelly and Poxy Tim and Hayhead and the rest.
Jojen's mussy eyes were full of pity.
They won't be able to stop him, Bran. I couldn't see why, but I saw the end of it. I saw you and Rickon in your crypts, down in the dark, with all the dead kings and their stone walls.
No, Bran thought, no.
If I went away to Greywater or to the Crow, someplace far where they couldn't find me,
it will not matter. The dream was green, Bran, and the green dreams do not lie.
Catelyn. Let the kings of winter have their cold crypt under the earth, Catelyn thought. The Tullys drew their strength from the river, and it was to the river they returned when their lives had run their course. They laid Lord Huster in a slender wooden boat, clad in shining silver armour, plate and mail. His cloak was spread beneath him, rippling blue and red. His surcoat was divided blue and red as well. A trout, scaled in silver and bronze, crowned the crest of the great helm they placed beside his head. On his chest they placed a painted wooden sword, his fingers curled about its hilt. Mail gauntlets hid his wasted hands and made him look almost strong again. His massive oak and iron shield was set by his left side, his hunting horn to his right. The rest of the boat was filled with driftwood and kindling and scraps of parchment and stones to make it heavy in the water. His banner flew from the prow, the leaping trout of River Run. 7 were chosen to push the funereal boat to the water in honour of the 7 faces of God. Rob was 1, Lord Huster's liege lord,
With him were the Lords Bracken, Blackwood, Vance, and Malister, Sir Mark Piper, and Lame Lothar Frey, who had come down from the Twins with the answer they had awaited. 40 soldiers rode in his escort, commanded by Walder Rivers, the eldest of Lord Walder's bastard brood, a stern, grey-haired man with a formidable reputation as a warrior. Their arrival, coming within hours of Lord Huster's passing, had sent Edmure into a rage. I have no doubt that Lord Walder chose his envoys with care, she replied. It was a peevish thing to do, a petty sort of revenge. But remember who we are dealing with, the late Lord Frey, father used to call him. The man is ill-tempered, envious, and above all, prideful. Blessedly, her son had shown better sense than her brother. Rob had greeted the Freys with every courtesy, found barrack space for their escort, and quietly asked Sir Desmond Grill to stand aside so Lothar might have the honour of helping to send Lord Huster on his last voyage. He has learned a rough wisdom beyond his years, my son. House Frey might have abandoned the king in the north, but the Lord of the Crossing remained the most powerful of Riverrun's bannermen, and Lothar was here in his stead. The seven launched Lord Huster from the water stair, wading down the steps as the portcullis was winched upward. Lothar Frey, a soft-bodied, portly man, was breathing heavily as they shoved the boat out into the current. Jason Malister and Titus Blackwood at the prow stood chest-deep in the river to guide it on its way. Catelyn watched from the battlements, waiting and watching as she had waited and watched so many times before. Beneath her, the swift wild tumblestone plunged like a spear into the side of the broad red fork, its blue-white current churning the muddy red-brown flow of the greater river. A morning mist hung over the water, as thin as gossamer and the wisps of memory. Bran and Rickon would be waiting for him, Catelyn thought sadly, as once I used to wait. The slim boat drifted out from under the red stone arch of the water gate, picking up speed as it was caught in the headlong rush of the tumblestone and pushed out into the tumult where the waters met. As the boat emerged from beneath the high, sheltering walls of the castle, its square sail filled with wind, and Catelyn saw sunlight flashing on her father's helm. Lord Huster Tully's rudder held true, and he sailed serenely down the centre of the channel into the rising sun. Now, her uncle urged. Beside him, her brother Edmure, Lord Edmure now in truth, and how long would that take to grow used to, knocked an arrow to his bowstring. His squire held a brand to its point. Edmure waited until the flame caught, then lifted the great bow, drew the string to his ear, and let fly. With a deep thrum, the arrow sped upwards. Catelyn followed its flight with her eyes and heart, until it plunged into the water with a soft hiss, well astern of Lord Huster's boat. Edmure cursed softly. "The wind," he said, pulling a second arrow. "Again!" The brand kissed the oil-soaked rag behind the arrowhead. The flames went licking up. Edmure lifted, pulled, and released. High and far the arrow flew. Too far. It vanished in the river a dozen yards beyond the boat, its fire winking out in an instant. A flush was creeping into Edmure's neck, red as his beard. "Once more!" he commanded, taking a third arrow from its quiver. "He is as tight as his bowstring," Catelyn thought. Sir Brynden must have seen the same thing. "Let me, my lord," he offered. "I can do it," Edmure insisted. He let them light the arrow, jerked the bow up, took a deep breath, drew back the arrow. For a long moment, he seemed to hesitate, while the fire crept up the shaft, crackling. Finally, he released. The arrow flashed up and up, and finally curved down again, falling, falling and hissing past the billowing sail. A narrow miss, no more than a handspan.